This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss the keys to better blood pressure with master herbalist Joel Thuna. We'll learn how psilocybin can help women over 50 heal with psychotherapist Heather Lee. We'll discover why parents shouldn't be friends with their kids with authors Leslie and Lindsay Glass. And lastly, we'll find out about the anti-inflammatory properties of cannabis with researcher Dr. Tariq Akhtar. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. Researchers at City of Hope have discovered a possible reason why people tend to gain belly fat as they get older, even if their overall weight stays about the same. Their study, published in the journal Science, found that aging triggers the appearance of a new type of stem cell that creates more fat cells, especially around the abdomen. The research team studied mice and later confirmed similar results in human tissue samples. They found that older fat stem cells were much more active than younger ones and produced many new fat cells. The scientists also identified a new group of age-specific stem cells called committed pre-adipocytes, CPAS, which appear during middle age and are especially effective at making fat cells. The study also showed a signaling pathway called leukemia inhibitory factor receptor, LIFR, plays an important role in helping these cells grow and produce fat. Researchers believe that understanding how CPAS and LIFR work could lead to future treatments that reduce belly fat, improve metabolism, and support healthier aging. More research is needed before these findings can be used in medical treatments. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Joel Thuna in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Feeling tired, low on energy, or simply not getting enough vitamin B12? Discover the difference with Purely Organic Active B12. Made with premium active methylcobalamin, the natural form your body absorbs and uses instantly. Unlike common synthetic B12 supplements, Purely Organic Active B12 contains no colors, flavors, sweeteners, or preservatives. Just clean, organic, vegan support for energy, endurance, and nervous system health. Purely Organic Active B12. Pure energy, naturally made in Canada. Joel Thuna is a master herbalist and general manager of Purely Natural. He strives to improve the quality of natural products in the market and passes along his knowledge of herbal remedies through lectures and articles. He's also a frequent guest on the show. Welcome back, Joel. How are you?
I am doing amazing today and always happy to be here.
So I don't go for annual physicals. I don't know if doctors even like do that anymore, but I did go to visit my doctor not too long ago because there was like a litany of things wrong with me that I did. And finally the tipping point was I needed to go in, and part of the workup is he took my blood pressure, which historically has been low. I inherited good low blood pressure from my dad's side of the family.
Lucky guy.
Some yucky stuff from his side too. But right in the middle of getting my blood pressure test, I'm a fool, I got this email that like really, really, really upset me. And so my numbers were like not what they should have been. And I tried to explain to him, you know, like, okay, maybe something happened that got me upset. I didn't want to give him the details of the email. But, you know, he said, well, you know, you just shouldn't have done that. But he didn't let me retest. I didn't get a do-over. So I'm telling you, my blood pressure was not good this time around. And we're going to talk about blood pressure today, yep. Right? Okay. And maybe you can tell me if that's okay or not okay. So blood pressure, high blood pressure, is often called the silent killer. Yep. Why is it earned that nickname, and why is it so important for people to know their numbers, even if they feel perfectly okay, fine?
Well, that's the insidious nature of high blood pressure. It's called the silent killer because you can feel perfect, amazing, awesome, no issues, all while your blood pressure is slowly killing you. Blood pressure, called hypertension, is the leading preventable cause of death, heart disease, kidney disease, and cognitive decline. So it's pretty important to get it right.
And there's 8 million Canadians who have been diagnosed, and there's probably more who haven't been diagnosed.
Yep.
What makes the high blood pressure such a widespread health concern?
Because of our lifestyles, our diets, the amount of exercise, the stress we're under, it makes us ripe for it. And because it causes progressive damage to things we need, our blood vessels, all our organs, including our heart, our brain, our kidneys, and our eyes, any change in it that's negative is going to cause damage, and it's damage we don't want.
All right. So, you know, we know that there's two numbers when you get a blood test.
Yep.
And beyond that, I suspect that a lot of people don't know what those numbers actually mean. Do you want to walk us through what those blood pressure test results look like and what they mean?
Sure. So you're going to get, when you get your blood pressure tested, and please, everyone should, everyone, it's measured, the units are millimeters of mercury. And if you remember going way back to when you had the thing on the wall of your doctor's office, it was actually mercury in a glass vial, and yep, it went up and down, and they still use that. And when it gets checked, you get two numbers. For example, 120 over 80. The top number is known as systolic. That's the pressure in your blood vessels when your heart beats and pushes the actual blood out. The bottom number is diastolic, and this is the pressure in your blood vessels when your heart rests between beats. Your systolic will be always higher than your diastolic for everyone, no matter what.
And what are current guidelines for, I guess, what would be considered healthy and not so healthy?
Okay. This gets a little tricky because it's fairly verbose. So normal is a systolic less than 120 and a diastolic less than 80. In this range, you're good, you're healthy, you are at what's considered the lowest risk. Then you move to the next level, which is called elevated, also known as high normal, depending on what your doctor decides to call it. And here your systolic is between 120 and 129, and diastolic is still below 80. In this range, your doctor's probably going to tell you, we need to monitor you more, we need to take more frequent tests, and he's probably going to give you some diet advice. Then you move into what's called hypertension stage 1. This is systolic between 130 and 139, diastolic between 80 and 89. And this requires multiple readings. No doctor is going to see that once and go, okay, you're hypertensive. They're going to do multiples, check them out, and confirm that it's not a one-off. And then they're going to start treating you. Then you move to hypertension stage 2. This is systolic over 140 or diastolic over 90. This often requires both lifestyle interventions and drugs. And then we move to the one no one ever wants to hear. The last category is hypertensive crisis, also known as stage 3. No one wants to hear that. That is where you have systolic over 180 or diastolic over 120. That is when you get immediate, you're going to get counseling, you're going to get lifestyle, you're going to get diet, you're going to get drugs, you're going to get the whole kit and caboodle because they're going to be really concerned.
The diagnostic threshold for hypertension have recently changed. Do you know what prompted these updates, and how is it going to help identify cardiovascular risk?
So what happened was both in the U.S. and Canada, they updated their criteria and their levels in 2025, and it was after a lot of consultation they did it so they could catch stage 1 earlier to avoid people tipping over into stage 2 and stage 3. The good news is it appears to already be working.
So lots of people have blood pressure testing equipment in their home.
Yep.
I actually have. And,
as do I.
You know, there's a difference between the time of day and what's going on, i.e. getting bad news from an email. So what are best practices if you're going to try and test yourself at home or even going to like a drugstore where they may have a free one for you to try?
Well, the first best practice is no one test really matters in and of itself.
Yep.
You have to do multiples, and not just multiples like, say, once every 2 days or once every 3 days or once every 4 days. When you're actually doing it, you want to do multiples at the same time.
Right.
So, for example, family members of mine, they'll do 4 at the exact same time every 2 or 3 days, and they average those 4 for Tuesday. They average those 4 for Friday, etc., and they keep a record of them. The other thing you want to do is make sure you're giving yourself the best shot at getting realistic, real numbers. So don't have your phone even near you, nowhere near you.
Good advice.
Don't be reading. A lot of people sit there and when they're doing it, they'll read a magazine or they'll read something else. Don't do that. It actually changes it. Sit comfortably, not over relaxed, but sit comfortably and actually have your arm on a surface like a desk, a table, etc., so you're not holding it up and having to change that. And the other thing is, a lot of people don't put the cuffs on properly. Almost every machine will actually have pictures of it. If you can't do it yourself, have someone else do it for you, but make sure it's actually done properly. If it's done just slightly askew, it will make a difference.
So, risk factors. There are some that are modifiable and some which are not. Which lifestyle factors have the greatest impact on blood pressure, and where should people focus their efforts if they're trying to bring those levels down?
Well, the big thing is there's what are considered to be 4 lifestyle factors that are modifiable that people can change. No one is in and of itself a solution.
Right.
It's a combination of all of them, so you don't want to focus on just one. It's better to go less extreme on one and do a little bit of the others because you're more likely to do it long term and succeed. And the 4 are diet, weight, exercise, and combined smoking and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very simple. I like to say, make better decisions with every single one of them.
Of course. Yep.
It does have an impact.
So let's focus on diet. Sodium, potassium, fruits, vegetables, all influence blood pressure.
Yes.
And what about eating patterns and you know, specific diets? Can we, like, where would you focus on with respect to eating?
Clinically speaking, the hands-down winner is what's called the DASH diet.
Mm-hmm.
It's called, the DASH stands for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been clinically proven time and time and time and time again in various different peoples, ethnicity, age groups. It doesn't matter. By following the diet, and there are different levels of it, but by following the DASH diet, you can see measurable results in as little as 2 weeks. And that is just, for something as serious as hypertension, that's incredible.
Right.
That's really amazing that you can see something in 2 weeks with a clinical difference.
All right. So let's lean into your expertise, which is supplementation.
Okay.
And are there supplements which can help this process, you know, accelerate the good effects of changing your lifestyle choices?
Definitely. One of the big ones is potassium.
Mm-hmm.
Our diets in typical Western diet are fairly low in potassium. Sodium tends to be much higher than potassium.
Yep.
Potassium actually, you can think of it as the anti-sodium.
Okay.
Everything that sodium does that's bad for you when it comes to blood pressure, potassium flips on its head
right.
and does the reverse. So it helps your body rid itself of excess water, reduces the amount of water in your blood, in your blood actually. And in doing so, it actually reduces blood pressure. At the same time, potassium actually helps prevent the sodium from doing its damage. So it does it in and of itself, and then it works to combat sodium at the same time.
What about magnesium?
magnesium is really interesting. Magnesium acts as what's called a calcium blocker. What it does is it prevents the calcium in our blood from actually attaching itself and lining our blood vessels.
Right.
The problem is when calcium lines your blood vessels, it actually hardens them.
Right.
And ideally, you want them nice, smooth, and very flexible so it can release, relax, and reduce blood pressure. And magnesium helps it do that.
What is nitric oxide and why is it important for maintaining healthy circulation and vascular flexibility?
Simply put, nitric oxide is a signaling molecule that tells your blood vessels to relax. If you take a nitric oxide supplement or a food high in nitric oxide, you can actually see very quickly blood vessels relax, blood pressure goes down. But it is a short-term effect.
Okay. Botanicals, again, your expertise. Let's talk about beetroot, reishi, mushroom extract, and peppermint essential oil.
Correct.
What does the research tell us about that?
It's actually quite fascinating. So beetroot is a rich source of nitrates. Your body efficiently converts these nitrates into active nitric oxide, which very quickly reduces blood pressure. After that, we talk about peppermint essential oil. And this one's actually fascinating because the research is really new. The paper I read came out, I believe, only about 2 months ago. And what they found is taking peppermint essential oil, and it has to be the pure oil, no dilutes, nothing. What it does, you take it orally twice a day, and it helps your blood vessels relax. It reduces the pressure inside them, and it lets your heart pump less and get the same effect. Now, reishi mushroom has a dual effect. It contains bioactive anti-inflammatory compounds that reduce systemic inflammation, which is one of the causes of hypertension. At the same time, it acts as a mild natural ACE inhibitor. And what that does is it reduces an enzyme that inhibits the relaxing of blood vessels. So by taking the reishi, you're stopping that enzyme from stopping other things, and together it works to relax blood vessels.
All right. So we've mentioned a lot of supplements towards the end of this interview. And, you know, when you go and you go to shop for them and they're all over the shelves, what should consumers be looking for in terms of supplements when we're talking about hypertension?
With this one, you want to be very particular because there's a big difference between a good supplement and a great supplement when it comes to blood pressure. Very specifically, the quality of how they manufacture it as well as the quality of the ingredients really matter. So what you want to do is you want to look for long-standing brands. Those are the brands that have been around for decades and decades. They tend to value efficacy of their products, and they don't hop on to social media trends. It's like, oh, this is hot this week. Let's modify our formula so that we can get this ingredient and hype it. No. They work on formulas that are efficacious and they know work. The second thing, you want to look for certificates. You want that independent validation and independent checking. So organic, kosher, GMP, vegan. A big one also is you want supplements that are manufactured in Canada. Not just brands that are Canadian, but actually have the products manufactured in Canada, because you want to know that when you look and say, okay, it has 50 milligrams of this or 40 milligrams of this, that they do have it in it, each and every dose, and that's required under Canadian law. The other thing is, you want to make sure that the supplement is bioavailable so that you get into you absorbed what you're actually taking. And with that one, you want to make sure you're using chelated soluble minerals for your minerals, or you want products that are in liquid form.
One last little piece of information. You have a little bit of a book plug you want to do?
I do. When I was researching this, I found there was a lot of information. I wanted to make sure I could get it all out there. Can't do it all today here. So we're putting up a free book you can go and get, and it's at betterbp.ca.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
That was Joel Thuna. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic.
Thank you.
I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Heather Lee is one of the first leading psychedelic-assisted psychotherapists with 25-plus years of clinical experience in integrative mental health. She has mind-body training from Harvard University and specializes in helping women build emotional resilience through transformational psilocybin experiences. She's a keynote speaker and leads international retreats that blend science, soul, and plant medicine to support healing, growth, and lasting inner peace. She's the author of The Psilocybin Sessions, Real-Life Stories of Women's Awakenings with Psychedelic Medicine, which is a Modern Wisdom Press release. And for more information, you can visit www.heatheralee.com. Welcome to the show, Heather. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so glad to be here, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
So we've covered psychedelics before on the show, but never in the context specifically of women over 50, which is kind of an interesting subset. So psychedelic medicine has moved from a fringe topic, I think you'd agree, to one being studied in universities and discussed in mainstream medicine. What's changed in recent years, and why do you think women over 50 are a especially important part of this conversation?
Well, you're right that there has not been much focus on women, especially older women with psychedelic medicine. Yet that's the demographic I serve, and they are extremely interested. And I think women get to this age, to their 50s, 60s, 70s, and they're recognizing that they've been carrying a lot with them that they're ready to put down, to travel more lightly, to have a fresh perspective. You know, I often say we don't go into, it's not that we're receding, it's time for us to be leading. And I feel like these medicines offer the opportunity to reawaken this deeper inner wisdom that we carry by releasing some things we no longer need to carry. And what's exciting is that right now, UC Berkeley, at their Center for the Study of Psychedelics, the Science of Psychedelics, is doing one of the first studies on healthy older women looking exactly at how psilocybin has benefits for women as they age.
For women who think, you know, quote unquote, I'm too old to change, how can psilocybin help them break free from some of these patterns of thinking?
Well, I have to first answer that with a quote from a woman that I recently worked with. So I was doing a retreat here in Colorado where now psilocybin is completely legal in the state of Colorado for anybody over 21 in a regulated and unregulated model. I won't get into all those details, but I was working with an 81-year-old woman, and she came to work with me and she said, you know, I've been a card-carrying bohemian my whole life, but I've never done the psychedelics, but I'm feeling ready and I want to do it with you. So she came and did a high-dose psilocybin journey. And when she's done, her quote was, you know what? You're never too old for psychedelics because they're about your soul. And that's the immortal part, which I thought was just the most beautiful comment. So, you know, we know that psilocybin has an incredibly high safety profile. And we're seeing more and more clinical results showing how effective it is at helping people manage anxiety and depression, but not just manage it. You know, mitigate it, like do neural rewiring to heal from anxiety, depression, grief. So for women in the later years of life where we have carried so much, this is an opportunity to truly do some neural rewiring so that we're able to process some of that grief. We're able to find ways to, you know, heal depression and anxiety so that we can live with more peace and presence. It's you know, really amazing. I mean, I just recently worked with Lisa Ling, the CBS ABC reporter. I worked with her 78-year-old mother who had some serious childhood trauma. And what this medicine let her do in a safe, supported session was to really go in, and much of it was somatic, but there's a release. It's that inner wisdom that we tap into where this medicine helps us move through, bring up, process, and release stored trauma, thus doing some healing and creating greater space for presence and joy.
So I gather the work that you do is sort of guided journeys as opposed to microdosing, or is there
elements?
So do any of the people that you're working with, do they microdose regularly, or is it more the former, the guided sessions?
So I would say most of my clients come to me to do, you know, really sort of clinical high dose journey experience for healing trauma, grief, anxiety, depression, but also sometimes just for expansion of consciousness. And I often start people who after they have done a high dose journey, we might start a microdosing protocol. You know, there's not as much research out there right now on the benefits of microdosing, but we do know that it acts on the serotonin receptor and it gives you that little boost of neuroplasticity. And, you know, some of the exciting benefits of psilocybin for women as we age and aging brains is that enhancement of cognitive function, is that ability of this medicine to put us into a more cognitive and psychological and emotionally flexible state, thus enhancing resilience, enhancing cognitive function, brain health. So I always say with microdosing for anybody over 50, it's no harm, no foul. There's really not a downside, and there's potentially a lot of benefit there, but the research is pretty new in that regard.
I actually tried microdosing a bit last year. But I have one, how shall I put this? I have a mind that tends to race. I'm very quick.
Yeah.
And I found it actually sped things up for me in ways that made me feel uncomfortable. And I understand for a lot of people, it's quite the opposite. But for me personally, just because I'm that person, it didn't quite work. But what do you see? Like, you talk about awe and wonder and connection. Why do you see that as being so relevant for people over 50?
Oh, it's one of my absolute favorite parts of working with this medicine. And just quickly back to your point, Jamie, you know, psilocybin is not right for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, there are people who have no business doing this, and there are certain contraindications. You know, if you've had any kind of a psychotic episode, if you have a history of bipolar, you know, even people that maybe had a really bad experience with a psychedelic earlier in life, that can set up a mindset that might be really challenging for you with this medicine. So it's not right for everybody. And it does need to be done really thoughtfully, mindfully, and with proper support. So I just wanted to quickly address that.
Yeah, no. I wasn't suggesting somehow that my experience extrapolates to everybody else. I was just saying that I have microdosed and I found it interesting. It just wasn't for me. But
exactly. But, and it's not for everybody. So about awe and wonder? And so one of the things that I always love to say is there is a reason they're called magic mushrooms. I have to say, you know, all the science in the world will never be able to explain what goes on when you are in this deep cycle, you know, different psychedelic state. You can put me in an MRI and you can map out everything going on in my brain. That is still not going to explain how I connected with like my great grandmother and had this meaningful conversation about, you know, or that I was able to see beyond and recognize that I am one with the whole universe and feel that in a deep embodied way that absolutely touched my soul. The things that happen on this medicine and when we are in these non-ordinary states, I say it is in the realm of mystery and magic, you know, even to the point that all of the mycologists and botanists in the world cannot explain why some of these fungi have this psychedelic medicine in them. It does not serve the plant any purpose. It only has the purpose that when we consume it, we have this psychedelic experience. So there's so many mysteries around this. And when people do psychedelic medicine, I like to say it's almost like you pull the curtain back. You know, you get to peek behind the curtain and see the magic and the mystery. You go on a mystical journey. I mean, we give people that mystical experience questionnaire after journeys, and the people that have the most lasting and profound healing and change are the people that have the more profound mystical experience. So much of this lies in the realm of mystery and magic, and none of the science that we have will ever be able to fully map out mystery and magic. And I am so okay with that. I think we need to be able to embrace and live with that sense of awe and wonder. And, you know, there's even the whole research center at Berkeley that just does study on awe and how powerful awe is on our immune system and our health. So I think there's a piece of this medicine, while we here in the Western world are sort of reclaiming it and packaging it and making it, you know, clinical and therapeutic, there's a part of it that that lies in the realm of magic and mystery. And I think we need to touch back into that as humans. I think part of our illness, our dis-ease, is that we've gotten so away from recognizing that when you go for a walk and you hear the birds and you look at the trees, you should be in awe. It is magical and wonderful. And so these medicines have a way of bringing us back into that state of wonder and awe. And we need that.
Let's talk about the mechanics of these guided sessions. Can you walk us through for the listeners what that's like? And is it something you would do more than once or once? How does it work?
Yeah. So, you know, a psilocybin session, a psychedelic assisted therapy session, should involve, when you're working with somebody who really, you know, is skilled, trained, licensed, certified, whatever, that really knows what they're doing with this medicine, it involves some preparation, which would be several sessions before you do the medicine, where you're talking about your intentions, you're talking about what to expect on the medicine, you're building a rapport and a trust with the person that you're going to work with so that you feel comfortable and safe. You understand what the setting's going to be, what, you know, the environment that you're in. So there's a lot of preparation. Then there's the day of the medicine. You consume this medicine in whatever form. When people work with me, it's usually as a tea that's got honey and ginger and lemon. It's very palatable. You drink that tea, and then for anywhere 4 to 6 hours, you're in this deep, non-ordinary state of consciousness. Something we call the journey, and that's doing high dose. So we're talking anywhere, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6-ish grams. That's what they use in the clinical research with high dose. You're very safe. You're lying down. It looks like you're taking a nap. You are behind eye shades. You've got music on in earphones. The music, these soundtracks are now curated pretty much by neuroscientists to follow the arc of the journey. They really evoke a lot of emotion. And so the whole journey is super inward. You're not looking around. You're not talking to your therapist. You are on your own inner journey. The therapist is there. They're very attuned and attentive. They're there for you. If you mumble stuff, they maybe get it. If you need a hand on your shoulder, they're there to support you or keep you safe. If you get up to go to the bathroom, then you go back. When you come out of that, there's a little bit of processing, but it takes, you know, it really takes the rest of the day for that to settle over you. So when people work with me, I wait till the next morning, I come back, and then we do a really deep dive into the integration. And the integration is when we're doing the meaning making. We're really exploring what came up for you. Let's talk about all the images and the symbols and the metaphors and the emotions and the somatic things that happened. And so we really work with everything that came up and use that to really help you kind of map out how you're going to lean into updating outdated patterns of thought, behavior, beliefs, because you're in this highly neuroplastic state now where your brain can really do an updating on outdated narratives. You know, it's an opportunity to lean into new ways of thinking about maybe things from the past, and thus literally like storing them in a different drawer, literally rewiring your brain around that. And then there would be another integration about a week later and probably another one a week later. So, you know, when people work with me, it's a container across a span of time that can be anywhere 10 to 15-ish hours or more, depending on how much integration you want. But it's not just come eat some mushrooms, I'm sitting there and you go home. That is a red flag. You know, if you're working with someone who's really committed to this, they're committed to your healing. It's in a container that goes across the span of preparation and integration.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show to explain that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was Heather Lee. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss why parents shouldn't be friends with their kids on The Tonic.
Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Leslie Glass is a journalist, recovery advocate, and the author of 12 books, including 9 USA Today and New York Times bestselling suspense novels. She's the co-founder of Reach Out Recovery and co-producer of the award-winning documentaries The Secret World of a Recovery and The Silent Majority. Lindsay Glass is an author, screenwriter, and co-founder of Reach Out Recovery, where her writing on relationships and wellness reaches millions worldwide. She co-produced The Secret World of Recovery and The Silent Majority and is the author of 100 Tips for Growing Up. Both Leslie and Lindsay live in Florida, and for more information about them, you can visit reachoutrecovery.com. Welcome back to the show, ladies. How are you?
We're great. Thanks for having us, as always.
Good to be with you.
So, you know, you guys are... You're a team when you come on the show, mother-daughter team, and you seem to get along very well. I don't know whether that is just a mother-daughter relationship or it veers into friendship, but I know you have some thoughts on that and boundaries, and I thought it'd be interesting to talk about that today. What do you think?
We have a lot of thoughts.
Well, she read your questions and we talked about them and she said, man, I did everything wrong, didn't I? So,
but isn't that
and
the whole...
Maybe that's why we were estranged for a while, because I did so many of these things wrong.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, we'll have to figure out what you did wrong and what you're doing right. Okay.
Yes. Okay.
So there is this notion, and there's kind of an impetus for parents to be friends with their kids, right? Like parenting styles are so much different than they were, you know, in past generations. Why do you think that message is so common, and what are some of the concerns that come with it?
I'm going to jump in. I really think it took hold for a couple different reasons. Two big reasons stood out for me. One is that parenting culture kind of made this shift towards empathy and emotional openness, which is honestly a really good thing. But somewhere along the way, it got tangled up with equality. I think the other big issue is a lot of parents were responding to their own upbringing.
Yeah, which was cold.
Yeah, and very distant, emotionally unavailable. So they made this very like grand vow that they were going to be warm and open and present. But it really slid into something else. So the concerning things is I really think it slid into parents needing to be liked by their children.
Yeah.
Avoiding conflict, because conflict feels like disconnection. And then we'll get into this more later, but the oversharing. So why it's concerning is because it sounds like love, and it you may even think it feels like love, but it actually functions as a burden on the child. Because children don't need other friends. They need a parent who will set rules and guidelines.
Yes, exactly.
So what we're focusing in on then is the parent-child relationship from what age? Like from birth till they're adults? Or are we, or do you feel like there's room for transition in the relationship after children become fully fledged, I'll say?
I love that question, because I think that parents and children are not equals for a long period of time. But I think Lindsay and I are now more like equals, because we both bring a lot of wisdom, restraint, and boundaries to the table.
I think the friendship can begin when the child is truly an adult, yeah. Not a 22-year-old, but somebody who's dealing with job stuff, having their own children, yeah. Their own marriages.
Yeah.
I think that that's a place where it's easier to be friends. But until you're in your early 20s, parents need to be parents.
Yeah, I would say a little bit longer, because children are taking longer to grow up these days. And they have been greatly spoiled, I think, in recent times.
I would agree. I think about like how I was left to my own devices in my early 20s, and how all my kids, and God bless them, like we just became an empty nester family like this past weekend. My youngest just moved out in his mid-20s. And, you know, I just think like... you know, my parents never helped me move, but like I was like, you know, not with this one, but with the others, you know, I was in the truck doing that kind of stuff. And you know, I'm just thinking, oh my God, I got a raw deal. So what does a healthy parent-child relationship look like, and how's that different from a friendship?
Well, let's just say that a healthy parent-child relationship simply means that the roles are clear. The parent is the adult, the parent leads, the parent is the safe harbor that the child returns to, not the other way around. So friendship is friendship. You can make friends, you can break up, and both people have equal needs, equal, say, vulnerability in the relationship.
Yeah, I think that's what came up for us the most. Yeah. In friendship, it's equal. And in parent-child, the parent is the one who needs to be able to sit with anger and disappointment and heartbreak, you know, without sharing it or making it about themselves.
And also creating the structure by which you live. You know, you do have to eat this. You can't have everything you want, that kind of thing. So, and also create emotional boundaries.
So what are some of the signs that things aren't quite right in the parent-child relationship?
So I think the warning signs, the clearest warning sign I thought about is when you find yourself going to your child for comfort. So suddenly the parent is having issues and sharing worries with them. And not because it's going to affect the child, but because it makes the parent feel better. So I think that that's the big red flag. Like where did this relationship reverse? And the child, in some now unspoken way, is parenting the parent. And the parent is now looking to the child for comfort.
But I would talk about codependency, too, when your child's mood determines your mood. And that goes for the parent as well. So what you need to pay attention to is not reversing those patterns. The child is... not supposed to take care of the parent.
Oh, divorce. That was a note we made. Yeah. You have to be especially careful going through divorces, that you're not using your child to discuss the details as an emotional support or giving them information that is not appropriate.
And I think that parents can get very needy if they're lonely or they're sad or they're having difficulties sharing.
Okay. So I think there's a fine line. Like, as your kids get older, you kind of recognize, like, they view you differently, right? When they're little, you can do no wrong. And then when they're teenagers, you can do no right. And then there's kind of an equilibrium. But I've always thought emotional honesty is kind of important with my kids. Like, they need to see the authentic you. And I think that's different than perhaps, like, telling them everything, right? Like, there's a fine line, isn't there? Like if I'm having a rough day, I can tell my kids. If I'm expecting my kids to change my mood or if I'm giving them too much detail that might freak them out, I think that's too much. But I don't know where that line is drawn. I don't know.
Well, I think the question you can ask yourself is, as you go to share something, you can ask yourself, you know, whose need does this serve? If I'm sharing this because you want to vent or you need to feel understood, I think maybe that is crossing the line. But I also agree with you. I think sharing a little bit of vulnerabilities and struggles and everything else is an important thing for kids so they can understand reality.
I think it's very important to be able to say, I had a bad day. That's why I'm impatient right now.
Oh, there you go. That's a really good one, actually.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I had a bad day, or I'm really tired right now.
Yeah, it is affecting them. Your behavior is affecting them, so you can give them some context.
Yeah, exactly. And I think giving context is great. And I think it's also great to explore your moods or your day with your children. You know, how was your day? What went well? What didn't go well? That kind of sharing is really important. But being needy and being able to vent to your children is probably not a good idea.
So how can families create healthy boundaries?
Okay, this is mine.
Okay.
I want to be really clear. I want to be really clear as a Gen Xer that was raised on hose water and neglect.
Yeah.
Healthy boundaries are not bad. we need to like get out of this idea that boundaries are in any way a negative thing. It is imperative to understand that children feel the most free to be themselves and to be vulnerable in their families and with their parents where the structure is clear. And it is clear to them that their parent is the adult in the room. So the opposite is true. When you have unhealthy boundaries, often kids, they feel responsible. They don't want to be themselves and they're hiding things.
Or they're scared.
So, you know, that's what I think. I think that actually parents need to understand that healthy boundaries create the structure that allow people to be more connected. And that can look like, you know, also asking the right questions. We've talked about that before. It looks like listening without immediately fixing, you know, and always making sure that their experience is about them and not your feelings about what's going on.
See, I think it's important to establish the grounding for the relationship because I think it changes over time. And at some point, the child doesn't become the parent, but may become a caregiver for a parent as they age.
I'm glad you're raising that. Yeah.
And the shoe's on the other foot. And I think you demonstrate the roles so that when the roles shift or reverse, there's empathy involved. I don't know if that makes sense.
That's playing out in our family right now. I am the caretaker of a father that was incredibly difficult. But because I was shown love and care in some ways, I'm now able to show him love and care.
Yeah. All right. So for listeners who may have recognized themselves in our conversation, what are steps they can take to begin building a healthy relationship with their child?
Mom, do you want to take this one?
I just want to reiterate what Lindsay just said. I mean, it's very important to listen. It's very important to be able to hear what your child is saying and be able to not try and fix everything for them. Be present. Be warm and loving.
I've got one more tip.
Not needy. Not needy.
I think that the parent also, if you have stuff going on, you need to find a friend or a therapist or somebody else that you can talk to, because there will be natural changes that take place within the relationship once you change your own behavior. It's not even a major conversation. If you start going to a therapist or a friend or taking this away from the kid will automatically adjust.
So the healthier the parent is, the healthier the kid is going to be.
Yeah.
Because kids like to see their parents being effective, happy, independent, able to manage themselves.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both for coming on the show today.
Oh, thank you.
That was Leslie and Lindsay Glass. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the anti-inflammatory properties of cannabis on The Tonic. You already know the importance of exercise for energy, improved strength, and better mobility. What you really need is an expert to show you how to exercise safely. Receive personalized coaching from Fitness Solutions Plus. Learn safe exercises for osteoporosis, diabetes, chronic pain, and balance issues from a fitness specialist. For a free consultation, visit fitnesssolutionsplus.ca. Number one in one-on-one fitness for adults over 50.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Dr. Tariq Akhtar is an associate professor in the College of Biological Science at the University of Guelph. His research focuses on natural products that are of medical, industrial, or pharmacological relevance, and on specialized metabolites that help plants cope with their dynamic environment. He employs a diverse set of approaches that rely on genomic, classic biochemical, and molecular biology resources. His collaborative work spans across organic chemistry, food science, neurobiology, and ecology. His research aims to elucidate the processes operating at the interface of primary and secondary metabolism in plants, with an emphasis on compounds that have medicinal, industrial, and pharmacological relevance. Welcome to the show, Dr. Akhtar. How are you?
Thanks very much, Jamie. It's a pleasure to meet you.
So we're going to talk about cannabis today, but in a way
that we haven't actually talked about it on the show before, and that has to do with its anti-inflammatory properties. Many people associate cannabis with THC and CBD, but your research focuses on lesser-known compounds called canflavins. What are they, and why have they generated so much excitement among researchers?
Well, really, in this country, just a few years ago, obviously, cannabis became part of our mainstream culture, right? And so that allowed us a bit of a landing pad to start investigating the plant in more detail. And, you know, what we found through the course of our investigations was that in addition to, you know, the psychoactive compounds like THC and the related CBDs, there's a whole host of other compounds that are found in the plant that have medicinal importance and therapeutic relevance. And this, you know, really builds on years and years of anecdotal evidence. I mean, cannabis has been used since antiquity to treat a variety of ailments. And so we just became interested in trying to understand, you know, what is it about the plant that provides people those therapeutic outcomes. And a few years ago, we stumbled across a group of compounds, which you just introduced, called the canflavins. And those are just some of the compounds that are found in plants. And our most recent research uncovered another one that I'll talk a little bit about today called cannabis stilbene. And these compounds together, we believe, are responsible for many of the therapeutic outcomes that are afforded to people who use cannabis for treating all kinds of acute and chronic pain.
So your team found that these naturally occurring compounds can reduce inflammation far more effectively than even aspirin in the laboratory setting. What makes them so powerful, and how do they work differently from traditional anti-inflammatory drugs?
Well, I don't want to take all the credit. I mean, a lot of this was already done prior to our getting involvement in researching the plant. A lady named Marilyn Barrett years ago identified the canflavins, and she was the one who really spearheaded this research interest in cannabis compounds that could potentially serve as anti-inflammatories. And we just built on that by looking for other related molecules in addition to the canflavins in the plant that could afford people those therapeutic outcomes. And so one of the things that's unique about these cannabis compounds, and first of all, these are not psychoactive, so people are not experiencing any sort of high from ingesting these type of compounds. These compounds are generally called flavonoids, which I'm sure many of your audience members have probably heard about before. A lot of people take flavonoids as supplements because they're potent antioxidants, for example. But a lot of these flavonoids that are found in cannabis are really specific. They're modified in a way that makes them really unique. And what makes them really powerful anti-inflammatories is they're really good at shutting down inflammation at the source in our bodies. And I think I'll spend a little time just talking about that so that your audience understands how inflammation works in our bodies. Our bodies have basically two pathways that lead to what are called pro-inflammatories. And these pro-inflammatories are what leads to inflammation. And when we take over-the-counter, what we call non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs, so these are things like aspirin, Tylenol, etc., these drugs are very good at shutting down one or the other pathway that exists in our bodies that lead to inflammation. And what makes the cannabis compounds unique is that these compounds actually shut down both pathways simultaneously. So this is what the pharmacological industry refers to as dual inhibition. And you're starting to see a lot of these drugs now kind of appear on the shelves of Shoppers Drug Mart, for example. So you'll often see this is Tylenol with a little bit of ibuprofen, right? Or we've got, you know, aspirin plus a little bit of acetaminophen. And so what drug companies are doing is that they are combining these really good inhibitors of inflammation together so that they can shut down inflammation at the source, targeting all the pathways that lead to the production of pro-inflammatories. So in a nutshell, that's what these cannabis compounds naturally do, is they shut down both pathways simultaneously, and that's what makes them so effective.
So lots of people suffer from chronic pain in Canada, and a lot of them, you know, are reliant on opioids, which, you know, we don't have time to go through all the dangers of opioids, but I think our listeners are pretty much aware of that. How could cannabis-derived compounds eventually change the way we treat pain while reducing the risk of addiction?
Well, yeah, that's precisely why we got involved. I mean, one in five Canadians are suffering from some form of acute and chronic pain. So this is a major, major problem. It's, you know, not just affecting productivity, but people's lives and their livelihood. So, you know, that's our motivation behind all of this. And we're still quite a ways away from being able to treat people who are suffering from chronic pain with cannabis compounds, but we feel like we're scratching the surface and identifying compounds that have that potential. And the hope is, and the goal really is to get these compounds out of their natural environment and into the hands of people who need them. And, you know, one of the things that we know from empirical literature and whatnot is that a lot of these compounds that we're talking about that are from cannabis are non-addictive, they're non-psychoactive. And so we know that they work differently than the way opioids work. So it's an alternative, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a non-harmful alternative with very low risk. And so that's why we're targeting these compounds.
So your research actually uncovered how the cannabis plant produces these molecules. Why was understanding that biological pathway such an important breakthrough?
So when we talk about how compounds are made, whether it's in a plant or, you know, in another organism, compounds like the canflavins or cannabis steel beans that we have been investigating for a few years now, they're built in pieces, and the pieces are assembled one step at a time, right? And you can kind of view it as an assembly line where, you know, you start with a substrate and that gets decorated or modified, and then it gets decorated and modified again. And there's a series of steps, right? And so in biochemistry, we refer to this as an enzymatic pathway, whereby you have these enzymes that are responsible for modifying substrates one after the other until it culminates in the synthesis of a product. And then we call that a biochemical pathway. And that's pretty standard. Most people who study this sort of thing, you know, appreciate that all compounds in plants and animals and in other organisms are built in pieces, and those pieces are derived from the activities of enzymes. And so if you want to understand how molecules are made, you have to understand how those enzymes work, right? And so that's where we come in. Is nowadays it's fairly straightforward that you can go into the genome of plants and other organisms and try to figure out what are the enzymes that are responsible for assembling these molecules. And so that's basically what our research looks at.
So what do you see as the biggest scientific or regulatory challenges that still need to be overcome before patients might actually see medication based on canflavins and these other molecules?
Yeah, well, you know, admittedly, I'm a scientist, and I don't really... I don't really understand the regulatory space all that well,
right.
But that's why I work with people who do. And so we've partnered with a small biotechnology company in Toronto named Canerta Incorporated, and they're interested in doing this. And they've been very successful at bringing natural products to market so far. And so the folks there at Canerta are the ones that have expressed an interest in taking the research that we've done and basically capitalizing on it and expanding it into bringing products to market. You know, I will add that these molecules that we're talking about are referred to as natural products, right? Mm-hmm. So the natural product space is a lot, I would say, less convoluted to navigate than if you're developing a drug, you know, from scratch and having to go through FDA approval or the equivalent here in Canada. So, you know, bringing natural health products to market are a lot easier. And so our hope, and, you know, we trust our partners in industry to be able to bring these products to public as soon as possible, while, you know, following the regulatory steps that fall under the natural health product umbrella.
Got it. Time for one last question, and that is, looking ahead, what excites you most about this research, and what do you hope its long-term impact will be for people living with chronic pain and inflammatory diseases?
Well, apart from the pure academic exercise of training the next generation of scientists and publishing work that, you know, you and others and everybody seems to get excited by, I think that the big outcome here would be to help people, right? You know, I don't need to remind your audience as to how prevalent acute and chronic pain is in our society. And we know that it really does affect people's livelihoods and prevents them from doing things that they would otherwise want to do. So I'm hoping that, you know, one day if we can bring some of these compounds to, you know, to the hands of people that need them in a way that makes sense, then everybody wins, right? So that's the long-term goal. And that's why we ultimately do what we do.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Real pleasure, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Joel Thuna, Heather Lee, Leslie and Lindsay Glass, and Dr. Tarek Akhtar. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.